A great scientist named Dr. Jared Diamond figured out how to use physics, chemistry, and biology to write a new history of civilization. His book is called Guns, Germs, and Steel. He did this about 10 years ago, so a lot of people haven't heard of it yet. Humans are made of atoms, food is made of atoms, and everything else in the world is made of atoms. We can't see atoms, though. To us, people, food, and everything else in the world look like different things. So we naturally think of them as different things. But people, food, and everything else in the world are only different things in the sense that they're different combinations of about 100 kinds of atoms. The atoms are only different from each other because they're made up of different combinations of protons, neutrons, and electrons, and those pieces of atoms are the same from one atom to another. This is another way that the world doesn't work the way people thought it did. I've already told you how chemistry works. Molecules contain energy in the molecular bonds between their atoms. Chemical reactions either absorb energy or give off energy as a result of molecular bonds being created or broken. When plants absorb sunlight through their leaves and nutrients through their roots, they use the sunlight energy to create new molecular bonds to turn the nutrient atoms into bigger molecules. Firewood, food, and fossil fuels are all made up of big molecules, which are broken when firewood and fossil fuels are burned and food is digested, which is why they all give off energy. Now here's what Dr. Diamond was able to do using biology and chemistry. The food cycle of an environment is the way atoms and energy move through an environment. In healthy environments, the atoms and energy keep moving at a consistent rate, which is why the environment sustains itself instead of breaking down. Plants absorb sunlight and nutrients. Herbivores eat plants. Carnivores eat herbivores. Carnivores eventually die and are eaten by bugs, worms, and bacteria. Those break the dead animals down into nutrients that are eaten by more plants. All of the energy that cycles through the environment came from the sun, except for some places where some of the energy comes from volcanic heat from underground. Atoms and energy move back and forth between people and the environment. Atoms and energy move from each person to the environment at a fairly consistent rate. If atoms and energy don't move from the environment to people at an equal rate, it means the people aren't getting enough to eat. That means you have a famine. When a woman gets pregnant, she needs to eat more. By eating more, she uses her digestive system and her uterus to turn topsoil nutrients into a baby. We are all made out of topsoil nutrients because our bodies are all made out of the food we've eaten. A lot of people think it's wrong to think of people as being made out of dirt, so they say we shouldn't use science to try to figure out how the world works. But just because you don't like thinking about a certain thing doesn't prove you have the power to make the world work differently than it does. Your body, including your brain, is made out of nutrients that came from the food you ate. The nutrients in your food came from the dirt. Like I said, we were created by the earth in the beginning, and we are still created by the earth now. I've heard that people where you live say that people are made out of corn. That's one example of farmers figuring out something by working with plants and animals all their lives, and scientists figuring out more about it by using their machines and spending their time studying these things. It's true that people who eat corn are made out of corn, but not everybody eats corn. People are made out of whatever food they eat. Their food comes from the soil. Since people are made out of food and food comes out of the soil, you can say that people are made out of soil. So this is an example of great scientists discovering that something peasant farmers believed is true, and not only that, it's even more true than the farmers believed it was. There are a lot of people here in America who don't believe that's true and who believe the world is supposed to work the way they want it to work, but they believe the world works the way they believe it works because they don't spend their lives working with plants and animals. A lot of people say they agree that people's bodies came from the dirt, but what about their minds? What about their spirits? What about their souls? Those aren't made out of dirt, so that must prove they came from somewhere else. People who make that argument are trying to use their own ignorance of science to prove they're experts at science. You are able to think about your mind, your spirit, and your soul because of your brain, and your brain is made out of dirt. Everything you're able to think about because of your brain, and your brain is made out of dirt. Your brain is an organ, just like every other organ of your body. Just like every other organ of your body, your brain does certain things, and thinking is what your brain does. Your brain is the most complicated organ of your body, which has made it the hardest to figure out. But just because something is hard to figure out doesn't prove that supernatural powers must be causing it. Just because something is hard to figure out doesn't prove that the simple version someone wants to believe must be true. That brings me to Dr. Diamond's history of the world. The world wasn't conquered by Europeans, whites, or Christians. The world was conquered by the people who were the most successful at turning topsoil nutrients into people. Those people turned out to be Europeans, whites, and Christians. It's easy to assume that their conquering the world had something to do with them being Europeans, whites, and Christians, but that's only because those things are a lot easier for people to see than how different parts of the world have different kinds of soil, and different kinds of soil produce different amounts of food. 10,000 years ago, people were spread out over all the habitable land in the world, with the exception of some islands they hadn't reached yet. The people in every part of the world were just like the people in every other part of the world. That meant that no group of people was superior or inferior to any other group of people because of who they were. In Mesopotamia, in the Middle East, the environment was the most favorable for people of any in the world. The soil in Mesopotamia produced more food that people could eat than the soil in any other part of the world. The soil in Mesopotamia had the highest food productivity in the world because it was the easiest place in the world for food plants to grow. That also made it the easiest place in the world for people to figure out how to grow their own plants because once people figured out how to plant seeds, it didn't really matter what they did after that. Through trial and error, they figured out a lot of things they could do to help the plants grow and produce more food as a result. Since the plants grew so well in the environment all by themselves, the Mesopotamians could afford to make more mistakes than anyone else in their learning process, which let them learn faster. The people of at least four other parts of the world, and maybe as many as eight, also developed agriculture on their own. The Chinese developed agriculture about 1,000 years after the Mesopotamians. The Maya and the Inca each developed agriculture about 5,000 years after the Mesopotamians. The Indians who lived in the Mississippi River Valley here in the United States developed agriculture about 1,000 years after that. There were also three places in Africa and a large island off the coast of Asia where the people might have developed agriculture independently, but scientists haven't found enough evidence to tell one way or the other. Scientists figured this out by digging up places where ancient people lived, which have been buried underground, and finding their food scraps. They can find out what plants the people ate by the corn cobs or whatever the people threw away, and they can find out what animals the people ate by the bones they threw away. Also, they can find clues from things like paintings and statues people made. They can also find clues from things like the weapons people made for hunting animals, the tools they made for harvesting their plants, the dishes they used for cutting up or grinding their food, and the baskets and pottery they used to store their food. Another big clue scientists use is the logs they find in ancient settlements. A tree is a calendar. The log has light rings and dark rings, which show how the tree grew each year. The light rings are created by softer wood where the tree grew quickly in the spring, and the dark rings are created by harder wood where the tree grew slowly in the summer. By counting the tree rings, you can find out how many years old a tree was when it was cut down. How fast a tree grows in a year depends on what the environment was like that year. If there was a lot of rain, the tree grows quickly, which makes the rings wider. If it was a hot and dry year, the tree grows more slowly, so the rings are narrower. All the trees in an area grow the same way every year, so their rings for each year look the same. If you cut down a tree that's 100 years old today, you can count backwards through the rings and find the ring that grew 50 years ago. Then if you find another log that someone cut to build their house, you can look to see if any of the rings in the old log match the rings in the new log. If the last ring in the old log matches the ring from 50 years ago in the new log, it means the old log was cut down 50 years ago. If that log also had 100 rings in it, now you can see how trees grew in the area 150 years ago. Then you can compare those rings to the rings in even older logs to see how trees grew even longer ago. When I say that people who spend their lives studying science and using machines to help them figure out things other people can't figure out, things like this are what I'm talking about. To make the transition from hunting and gathering to farming, a group of people needed four things. First, a population that had grown too big for them to support by hunting and gathering anymore. Second, they had to lead sedentary lives. Third, they had to have a high enough technological level. Fourth, they had to have the right variety of plants growing in the area. The population had to have grown too big for the environment to support by hunting and gathering for a simple reason. Everyone knew how to hunt and gather because people had been doing that for as long as people had existed. Hunting and gathering is what all the animals do. Farming was a completely different way to produce food because it depended on people figuring out how to put seeds in the ground to make them grow and make a lot of long-term plans for what their plants were going to need, when, which plants they would be able to eat at which times of the year, and so on. All the things you do on your farm. That means that before people learned how to farm, they knew how to hunt and gather well, and they didn't know how to farm well. The only thing that could have made spending their time farming seem like a better idea than hunting and gathering would have been if they couldn't produce enough food by hunting and gathering anymore, so they were trying to think of something else. If the people lived in an area where they couldn't produce enough food by hunting and gathering anymore, that gives us more clues about the way they lived. First of all, they moved into the area because they could find enough food by hunting and gathering. If they couldn't, they wouldn't have moved into the area. Second, if the environment couldn't produce enough food anymore, it means they had more children than they should have for the amount of food they had in their environment. They had too many children and ate their food too fast. At first, there were only a few people, and there was a lot of food in the environment. Now there was less food, which means the people must have been eating the food faster than the environment could produce it. That means there must have been more people. That means that somebody must have been having a lot of babies. So this is an example of how an environment breaks down when people turn too many soil nutrients into too many babies. The people had to lead sedentary lifestyles for a simple reason also. When people of today think of hunter-gatherers, they think of nomadic hunter-gatherers, like people who live in the jungles of the Amazon. All hunter-gathering people are nomads now, because most all of the land that's good for farming has been turned into farms. Before people learned how to farm, things were different. Then people lived on the land that was good for farming, but they weren't farming. That meant their environment was completely different. Land that's good for farming is good for farming because it's so productive of plants. Before people started farming, it would have been very productive of plants also, It just would have produced different plants. If the land was so productive that people could find all the plants they needed growing nearby year-round, then they basically lived on a farm that didn't need a farmer. If the people lived on land that was so productive that they didn't have to move around over the course of the year to follow herds of animals and the growing seasons of plants, that let them do something important. That let them stay in one place year-round, which is exactly what people have to do in order to farm, or to learn how to farm. Nomadic people couldn't afford to stop and try to figure out how to farm because they had to keep moving to get their food. People who could live in the same place all year-round could go collect their wild food, and then they had time to experiment with growing their own plants until they figured out how to do it right. Another advantage sedentary people had in learning how to farm is that when they went out, found their wild food, ate it, and threw their scraps away, they used the same refuse dumps all year round. That meant that some of their food scraps still had good seeds in them, and they were throwing their seeds into piles of fertilizer. Then they stayed there for the rest of the year so they could watch new food plants grow out of their refuse dumps where they threw the food away from last year. One other important difference between sedentary and nomadic life was that nomadic mothers could only carry one child at a time. That meant they had to have their children about 4 years apart so that each child would be big enough to be able to walk on his own without slowing down the tribe on its travels. Sedentary families didn't have that problem. People also had to have the right technology to be able to learn how to farm. Sedentary people who harvested a lot of wild food had an advantage here again. When nomadic people moved around, they had to carry everything they owned with them. That meant they could only own simple things, and the things they owned had to be things they could use for a lot of different things they needed to do to be able to live. Sedentary people, however, didn't need to be able to carry everything they owned when they moved. That let them own more things, and it let them build specialized tools for doing things they only needed to do a few times a year. That let them build better tools for harvesting plants. Sedentary people could also store food to eat later in the year. That was critical to being able to learn how to farm. Nomadic people couldn't carry a year's supply of food with them, and they couldn't find a year's supply of food anywhere they went. Buildings for storing food in was an important part of farming technology, because in order for people to start farming year-round, they had to be able to save up a year's supply of food to eat while they were waiting for their next harvest. That meant the people had to invent the buildings for storing their food in before they could learn how to farm, because without the buildings, they couldn't store enough food to eat while they were waiting for more food to grow. A group of people had to have a good combination of plants growing in the area so they could grow a well-balanced diet. If they didn't have the plants they needed for a well-balanced diet, they couldn't afford to devote all their time to farming. That meant they couldn't afford to give up hunting and gathering. There are a lot of foods people grow today that aren't good staple crops. That means they can get some nutrients out of them, but not enough to live on year-round. People couldn't learn how to farm with those because, really, the people weren't trying to learn how to farm. They were trying to figure out how to produce the food they needed to live. Some people learned how to farm because that was the best way they could find to produce the kind of food they needed. If gathering wild plants was the best way they could find to get the food they needed, they would have done that, and they wouldn't have bothered going to all the trouble of learning how to farm just so they could grow food that wouldn't be very helpful to them. When a group of people learned how to farm, they started by growing highly nutritious food first. But that also means that, in order to be able to learn how to farm, a group of people had to have plants growing in the area that could produce a lot of nutritious food and that were easy to learn how to farm. Also, the plants the people started farming with had to be plants they could store and eat all year round. Grain is good for that, so are roots and vegetables that can be dried easily. A lot of food, like fruits and some vegetables, only stay fresh for a few days or a week after they're harvested. Once people learned how to grow a well-balanced diet that they could eat all year round, then they could start planting more crops to grow food they didn't depend on to live. Then they could afford to grow some food they would only be able to eat at certain times of the year when it was fresh from the harvest. Then they could afford to grow fruits and vegetables and spices to go with their staple foods. So now we come back to the story of Cortez and Montezuma getting into a war over whether people were supposed to eat wheat and peas or corn and tomatoes to be healthy. The people of Mesopotamia had two kinds of wheat, barley, peas, chickpeas, lentils, bitter vetch, and flax growing in their area. That was three kinds of grain, four kinds of vegetables that were high in protein, and a fiber crop they could use for making clothing and rope, and save themselves the trouble of hunting and gathering for those things. The Maya domesticated corn, beans, and squash to give them their combination of grains, vegetables, and protein. Once the farmers could support themselves with well-balanced diets year-round, the Mesopotamians and Maya domesticated a lot more local plants. Once we can see that the Mesopotamians and Maya started with the same four environmental conditions, and so did every other part of the world where the people learned how to farm on their own, we can look at the differences to see why they developed their agriculture differently. Each of those groups of people lived in different environmental conditions, so some of those four things they had in common affected them differently, some more, some less, and some in unusual ways. Each group of people also had differences that affected how much they could use agriculture, what they could use it for, and what they were able to do after they learned how to farm. The Mesopotamians had seven more important advantages over every other group of people who learned to farm. First, Europe, Asia, and North Africa make up the biggest landmass in the world by far. That makes it the landmass with the most kinds of plants. Of the 56 best grain-producing species of wild grasses in the world, 32 of them grew in Mesopotamia. Of the 8 original crops of the Mesopotamians, flax and barley were the only two that grew wild in many other places outside Mesopotamia, while one kind of wheat and chickpeas only grew wild in or around Mesopotamia. Second, with the exception of Australia, the smallest continent, Eurasia, North Africa, is the only continent that's longer east to west than it is north to south. That means it has the largest number of places with similar growing conditions because of similar cycles of sunlight throughout the year. The approximate latitude of Mesopotamia stretches from the coast of Portugal to the coast of China. The entire coast of the Mediterranean Sea has the same basic climate as Mesopotamia did at the time, and so did other places in Asia. That meant that even though the Mesopotamian plants were so highly concentrated in Mesopotamia, once they were domesticated, they could be planted in other places. After those plants were domesticated, it was much easier for Mesopotamian agriculture to spread into other areas than it was for the people who lived in other places to learn how to farm on their own. That's why it's so difficult to determine if one of the 9 possible centers of original agriculture was an original center of agriculture. Mesopotamian agriculture spread into northeastern Africa almost immediately. Local plants were domesticated in the area around the same time Mesopotamian plants were adopted, but it's impossible to tell which came first, if they inherited Mesopotamian agriculture and then started domesticating their own plants, or if they started domesticating their own plants and then added Mesopotamian plants soon after. Third, the plants that grew in Mesopotamia were the easiest to domesticate in the world, because of the Mesopotamian climate. hot, dry summers, wet winters, and variable weather conditions. That created hardy plants and a large proportion of annual plants. That made the plants of Mesopotamia the easiest to domesticate because they needed the least amount of attention after people stuck the seeds in the ground. Fourth, the Mesopotamian plants had the greatest ratio of calories to food produced to calories of work energy required to raise the food. Food is the fuel of civilization. The plants the Mesopotamians had let them turn their soil nutrients into food the easiest, so that let them turn food into babies the easiest. That advantage alone would have made the civilization built on Mesopotamian agriculture the biggest and most physically powerful civilization in the world. Fifth, humans evolved in Africa and spread into Europe and Asia fairly quickly. That meant the animals that lived on those continents had time to evolve a fear of humans while the humans were still figuring out how to hunt. Humans didn't reach Australia until 40,000 years ago and didn't reach the Americas until 14,000 years ago. By the time humans reached those three continents, they had well-developed hunting skills and the animals they found had no natural fear of humans. The humans soon hunted numerous animal species into extinction. The same thing almost happened more recently when humans first traveled to the Galapagos Islands in Antarctica. The animals there had no natural fear of humans either, so people almost hunted many of those animals into extinction also. The explorers could practically walk up to the animals they found there and kill them with their bare hands. It sounds strange to most people because in most of the world, all the wild animals are naturally afraid of humans. The reason for that is perfectly simple. All the wild animals that weren't naturally afraid of humans got killed and eaten thousands of years ago. That hunting of animals into extinction prevented the people on those three continents from domesticating any large animals, with the exception of the Incas' domestication of the llama in the mountains of Peru. Dogs and various types of rodents and birds were domesticated all over the world. Rabbits were domesticated in Europe. Silkworms were domesticated in China. And cats were domesticated in Egypt. But those smaller domesticated animals couldn't do as much. Agrarian societies that didn't or couldn't domesticate large mammals couldn't use them for meat, milk, leather, wool, or fertilizer, and couldn't use them as draft animals, transportation, or for warfare. For instance, the Maya domesticated dogs and turkeys, while the Incas domesticated llamas and guinea pigs. Mesopotamia was the home to the wild ancestors of cattle, sheep, goats, pigs, and camels, while horses and donkeys both originated nearby. In addition to providing the Mesopotamians with meat and milk, those animals also provided them with wool for clothing and blankets, leather for clothing and armor, and they turned a lot of grass into fertilizer that the Mesopotamians could spread on their crops. The Inca and the Maya could use their animals for those things, but not as much. Oxen, camels, horses, and donkeys could be used to pull plows to cultivate soil that was too hard to cultivate by hand. They could carry riders faster than humans could walk on their own. They could carry more cargo than a human could carry, and they could pull carts, wagons, and chariots. The Incas could use llamas to do some of those things, but not as much. Meanwhile, the Maya and later the Aztecs had to build their empires entirely by human muscle. The sixth geographical advantage was Mesopotamia's location in the center of the best climates of Europe, Asia, and North Africa. Mesopotamia lies in the middle of the longest stretch of land in the world with similar latitudes and growing conditions, where domesticated plants, and consequently agrarian civilization, could spread easily. That put it in literally the best place in the world for trade routes. That meant the Mesopotamians could get more things from outside their land than anyone else in the world, and they could get things from further outside their land than anyone else in the world. That includes simple things like raw materials and things people made themselves. More importantly, it includes the ideas of how to make those things. If someone who lived far away invented a new thing and you got one, you could see how it was made and what you could do with it, and then you could start making them yourself. This also includes abstract ideas like writing, mathematics, metalworking, new farming techniques, and new forms of government. Then, the more ideas you bring together, the more ideas you can combine with each other to invent more new things. For instance, if you were farmers and you learned how to domesticate horses from one group of people, and you learned how to forge metal from another group of people, you could figure out how to build metal plows that work better than wooden plows. The seventh geographical advantage that contributed to the success of Mesopotamian agriculture never benefited the Mesopotamians themselves, but it's the main advantage that broke the tie between the success of the Mesopotamian and Chinese agriculture. Europe and China are both large areas on the largest continent with equitable plant and animal resources. They both shared the first five geographical advantages. Even though China was at one end of the continent instead of right in the middle, it was still part of the Mesopotamian trade route, so everything that reached Mesopotamia could reach China also, even if it took longer. The geographical advantage that set Mesopotamian agriculture ahead of Chinese agriculture was the fact that Europe is divided by numerous seas. That made it easy for people, crops, technology, information, and ideas to travel throughout Europe, but it created a great obstacle to political unification. That meant that people in numerous countries were constantly aware of what the others were doing. They were constantly trading, borrowing, and stealing each other's developments, and they were constantly competing against each other, first in open warfare and later to colonize empires around the world to take advantage of natural resources from other places. Various empires rose and fell in Europe throughout most of history, but in the end, they all fell. It was fairly easy to wage wars of conquest against other countries in Europe by sailing the seas, but afterwards, controlling conquered lands across the seas was more difficult. China has two of the world's largest rivers, the Yellow River to the north and the Yangtze River to the south. Agriculture might have originated independently on both rivers, and one way or another it had to be developed on each, because their climates are too different to allow crops to be transplanted directly from one to the other. Either way, they were fairly close to each other, and they didn't have any major barrier between them, so they were quickly joined into one agricultural civilization. Rivers are much easier to travel than seas, which allowed people, crops, inventions, news, and ideas to travel easily throughout China, and they were an asset to political unification, because rivers were the highways of the ancient world. China achieved political unity about 2,500 years ago and kept it intact fairly consistently ever since. The Europeans are still trying to figure out how to unify politically right now. At first, that let the Chinese get ahead of the Europeans in their Mesopotamian agriculture, in spite of the Mesopotamians' thousand-year head start. When Marco Polo traveled to China from Europe, he brought back many strange and wondrous Chinese inventions, including gunpowder. But that early political unification became China's downfall. The Chinese were much more powerful than all their neighbors for so long, they didn't need to compete with anyone. The kings of the separate kingdoms of Europe kept trying to get ahead of each other, so they ended up getting ahead of the Chinese, too, in the process. But no one realized that until much later. The people of Mesopotamia had another advantage that's worth mentioning. To the east, the mountains rose 5,500 meters above sea level. Different elevations had different growing seasons. The fruits and vegetables at each elevation evolved to make full use of their growing season. That meant that people could migrate up and down the mountains over the course of the year as fruits and vegetables ripened at different times. That also meant the people could bring a variety of seeds down to plant on the farms, and those fruits and vegetables would be ready to harvest and eat at different times of the year, instead of all of them ripening at once. Now we can look at the differences between the environments of the Maya and the Mesopotamians. First was their difference in animals, which I already told you about. The Mesopotamians could use horses, donkeys, and oxen to plow land that was too hard for a person to plow by hand. It also let one farmer farm more land. It also let a farmer use animals for other agricultural jobs like threshing, grinding, and irrigating. The Maya couldn't use animals for any of those. The Mesopotamians could use their animals for a lot of meat and milk, and the Maya couldn't. That meant the Mesopotamians could use their animals to turn grass that people couldn't eat into food people could eat. The Mesopotamians could also use their animals for a lot of leather and wool, which meant they had a couple of raw materials to use that the Maya didn't. The Mesopotamians could also use their animals to turn grass into good fertilizer for their crops. The Maya couldn't do that. A big difference the Maya's lack of animals caused was the size of the countries the Maya and other people in Mexico and Central America were able to build. An empire is an economic system where people pay taxes and the emperor decides how to use them. If you have 100 people in a farming village or 1 million people in an empire, the 100 people in the farming village might like each other better and might be happier with their lives, but the 1 million people in the empire have 10,000 times more people, energy, and resources on their side. That's why people from huge empires usually conquer villages full of happy farmers, but I guess I don't need to tell you about that, do I? To build an empire, you need an army. Otherwise, the people don't pay their taxes. They keep them for themselves. The size of the empire is limited by how far the army can travel. The army can only conquer people whose lands they can reach. The kings of Europe could build big empires because their armies had horses and oxen to ride or to pull wagons full of supplies while their armies marched on foot. The Mayan emperors didn't have draft animals, so they had to use their armies differently. All the food the Mayan armies brought with them while they were marching had to be carried by men. But the men who carried the food had to eat some of the food they were carrying while they were marching. The further the army marched, the more of the food carriers had to eat to be able to march. That meant the less of the food there was left to feed the rest of the army. That meant the sizes of the empires was limited to the land the armies could reach within about a week's march, because they didn't have any way to bring enough food with them to march any further than that. That meant the Maya built smaller empires, and their empires fought each other, broke up, and formed new empires and alliances a lot more frequently than the Europeans did, because it was a lot harder for people to build empires and a lot easier for people to break away from empires in Mexico than it was in Europe. Another important difference between the Maya and the Mesopotamians was that corn was a lot harder to domesticate than wheat or barley. Wheat was the easiest crop in the world to domesticate because all the Mesopotamians had to do was to bring it home and plant it. Corn, on the other hand, was so hard to domesticate that the greatest biologists in the world today still can't figure out how the Maya did it. That's a big reason the Mesopotamians learned how to farm 5,000 years before the Maya did. The closest wild relative of corn is barely edible to people, and nothing biologists have tried has ever turned it into a kind of plant that is edible enough to people to be worth the trouble of growing it. Farming takes energy, and food crops contain energy. If the food you grow doesn't contain more energy than you have to spend to grow the food, ancient people couldn't grow the food because the food wouldn't replace the energy they had to expend to grow it. If ancient farmers tried that, they couldn't grow enough food to keep themselves alive, so they would starve to death. Of course, long before they starved to death, they would give up on farming whatever they were farming, because farming it wouldn't be doing them any good. Another problem with corn compared to wheat and barley is that wheat and barley have a lot more protein in them than corn. That's an important nutrient people need to live. Another problem the Indians faced that the Europeans didn't was that it was a lot harder for agriculture to spread through the Americas. I've already told you how Europe and Asia are longer east to west than they are north to south. The Americas are just the opposite because they're longer north to south than they are east to west. It takes a lot longer for farmers to be able to move their crops north or south because as you move north or south, the daylight cycles change. The further from the equator you go, the longer the days get in the summer and the shorter they get in the winter. Moving very far north or south requires you to breed new crops as you go. The Americas are almost completely separated into two continents. Central America is only 40 miles wide at its narrowest point, which is also covered by dense jungle. The Maya and the Incas built great empires, but there's no evidence that the Maya and the Inca ever met each other or even knew about each other. Each of them had things the other could have used, and neither of them ever got those things. For instance, the Inca had llamas and had learned how to build roads, which would have been valuable to the Maya. The Maya had invented writing and wheels, which would have been valuable to the Incas. The Europeans traded ideas like those over much greater distances than the distance between the Maya and the Incas, but they didn't have great obstacles between them. It isn't just a question of how far apart two groups of people live, but of how easy it is for them to travel between their two lands. Also, there are a lot of jungles and deserts in the Americas, and there aren't any jungles or deserts in Europe. Crops that grow well on plains don't grow very well in the jungle or desert. If you learn how to farm well in deserts or jungles, you can't grow your crops very well anywhere else. So, if you learn how to farm on the plains, build farms all over the plains, and then reach a desert at the edge of your plains, you've basically run into a wall. If you want to move into the desert, it will be very difficult or impossible for you to bring your crops with you. Instead of moving into the desert, it would be a lot easier for you to move in a different direction where there were more plains. If you do move into the desert and can bring your crops with you, it will take you so long to build farms in the desert, breed plants that can grow in the desert, and cross the desert by building new farms each year, that by the time you reach the other side of the desert and find more plains to plant your crops in, you won't have crops that grow well on the plains anymore. You'll have crops that will grow well in the desert. Or you could cross the desert quickly, but to do that, you would have to leave your crops behind and feed yourself by hunting and gathering wild plants and animals in the desert. If you do that, by the time you reach the plains on the other side of the desert, you still won't have any crops to plant there. Here in the United States, we have a lot of plains where we grow a lot of food now, but Native American farming never reached those places because we have lots of deserts in the western and southwestern parts of our country. Native Americans here in the United States built farms in the eastern part of the country where they learned how to farm on their own. They also built farms in the southwestern part of the country where they got crops from the Maya. And corn spread all the way to the east coast where the first European explorers found it. But there were no farms in the western part of the country or in our central plains until the Europeans came and built their own farms there. The last big difference I need to talk about between the Europeans and the Native Americans was the diseases the Europeans brought with them. The Mesopotamian and European farms that produced so much food for people also produced a lot of food for germs. They did this in a lot of ways. First of all, producing all that food and having all those babies let the people build big cities. But in those cities, the people were packed densely together. That meant there was a lot of garbage and filth in the cities. That meant there were a lot of places for germs to live and then infect people. The people owning so many animals was another way for diseases to infect people. The animals had their own diseases, and sometimes diseases that affected animals could affect people too. Also, the manure from the animals was another place for germs to live. Draft animals let people transport food further, so that let people live further away from the farms they depended on for their food. Being able to live further away from the farms let people build bigger cities. For all these reasons, a lot more germs evolved in Europe than evolved in the Americas. A germ is basically a tiny animal that eats people. When germs infect people, they attack the person's bodies and start eating the people. In order for the germs to survive as a species, they need the person to pass some of the germs on to another person before that first person dies. For most diseases, you get a little bit sick, you can pass the germs on to someone else, and then you get over your sickness. That means your body kills the germs in you, but by then you've already passed some germs on to someone else. That means the germ survives as a species, even though the germs that were infecting your body are dead. The germs you passed on now infect someone else. They start eating his body, and they start making more germs, which means they make more germs like themselves for that person to pass on to someone else. With a germ that makes you a little sick, if it takes you a week to pass the germ on to someone else, the germ can't afford to make you very sick. It has to keep you alive for a week, and it has to let you move around so you can come into contact with other people and infect them. The germs in your body are killing you, but they're killing you so slowly that your body can fight them off before they do. But the germs have to let you do that, because otherwise they can't reproduce. If you think of this like the germs are planning on what to do, it doesn't make any sense, because then it sounds like the germs that infect you are planning on letting you kill them just so they can reproduce. This is one place where it's good to remember how life began. These germs are making copies of themselves, just like the original gene molecule made copies of itself. The life cycles of germs are more like a chemical reaction than they are like life as we normally think about it. Inside the germs are gene molecules that are replicating themselves by the same basic chemical reaction that's been going on for 3.5 billion years. In order for the molecules to make copies of themselves, they're taking the atoms they need to make the new molecules out of your body, which is why the germs are eating you. If the germs ate you too quickly, you would die, and all the germs in you would die, so the germs wouldn't make more germs like themselves in someone else. So that isn't how germs are normally transmitted from one person to another. Instead, the germs that get transmitted from person to person are the kind that leaves the person healthy enough to recover from his sickness and kill all the germs in his body. If you crowd a lot of people together in a big, filthy city, you make it a lot easier for a person who has a disease to infect another person with it. If you can pass the germ on to another person in a day instead of a week, the germs can eat you a lot faster. For that matter, if your city is so filthy that when you die, you'll still transmit the germs to someone else before they bury your body, that will also help you spread the germs to more people. That let germs evolve. First, you have a disease that makes people sick but doesn't kill them. Usually, when germs make more copies of themselves, they make more germs just like themselves. But sometimes, something changes unexpectedly, and they make a germ that's a little different from themselves. If that new germ eats you more quickly, it can make more copies of itself than the old germs can. That means now you have two kinds of germs. The ones that eat you more quickly get the atoms they need to make more copies of themselves more quickly. So even though you only started out with one of the new germs, it makes more copies of itself than the old germs were making of themselves. If this goes on for hundreds of years, every time a germ changes into a germ that can eat you more quickly, and you still pass the new germs on to other people, those new germs don't die out. So, if you live in a big, crowded, filthy city where you can infect someone else with your germs in one day, germs that eat you quickly will be able to survive and spread to other people. If the germ kills you in 2 days, but you only need 1 day to infect someone else, the germ can make a lot of copies of itself in 1 day. Then you'll have a lot of germs to pass on to someone else. Then the next day you'll be dead, but some of your germs will be eating someone else and making more copies of themselves in that person's body. If you need 1 day to infect another person, but you live in a big, crowded, filthy city where you can still infect people when you're dead, the germ doesn't need to keep you alive. If the germ kills you in 1 day and makes so many copies of itself that it infects someone else before they can carry you out of the city and bury you, that germ will go right on making copies of itself and killing lots of people. That's exactly what the plagues in Europe did. The people who survived the plagues in Europe were the ones with the most resistance to disease. This made people evolve. The people who survived the plagues had more children than the people who didn't survive the plagues. The people who survived the plagues survived because they had genes that gave them better resistance to disease. So when they had children, they made more children like themselves. That meant they passed their disease resistance on to more members of the next generation. After the plague swept through Europe, the Europeans who survived had better resistance to disease than the Europeans had before the plagues came. The germs weren't gone, they just weren't affecting people as much anymore because the people who were left had better disease resistance. Then when the Europeans came to the Americas, they brought their diseases with them. The Indians they met hadn't been exposed to the diseases before, so they caught a lot of European diseases and suffered plagues like the Europeans had before. Something that has been discovered recently is that Native Americans don't have as good of resistances to diseases as the Europeans did even before the Europeans got the plagues. The reason for that is people had lived in Africa, Asia, and Europe for as long as people had existed, so they had moved around a lot and passed their disease resistance genes around to each other. The Americas was settled by a fairly small group of people who lived in one corner of Asia. They didn't have as much disease resistance in their group as the people had in all of Europe. That meant they didn't have as many genes for disease resistance. That means they didn't bring as many genes for disease resistance to America. That means their descendants didn't inherit as many genes for disease resistance as people did in Europe. That's one reason it's been so hard to figure out how many Native Americans were killed by diseases, because the number was so much bigger for Native Americans than it was for Europeans that a lot of people thought the numbers must be wrong. In Europe, the plagues killed about 1 out of every 3 people. In the Americas, it was more like 9 out of 10 people or something like that. I should add here that the Native Americans being descended from a smaller group of people made them healthier in some ways than the Europeans ever were, especially before the Europeans brought their plagues. In the same way that the small group of people only brought a few genes for disease resistance when they came, they also brought only a few genes for disease with them. There are some genes people have that give them diseases because those genes don't work very well with other human genes, so they make people unhealthy. But the small group of people who settled the Americas didn't have a lot of those genes either. That meant the Native Americans couldn't inherit a lot of disease genes that affected Europeans because nobody's ancestors had brought those genes into the Americas in the first place. People learning how to farm started a lot of big changes in the world. The people who were learning how to farm didn't know what was going to happen as a result of what they were doing. All they knew was that they were producing food the best way they could find. People who hunted and gathered wild animals and plants each had to be able to produce their own food. The economic relationship between people and the environment was simple enough that people had to be self-sufficient. Since the people lived in a wild environment, they each had to know how to do everything they needed to do to live in their environment. That included producing their own food, making their own tools, and building their own homes. There was some basic division of labor between men and women, adults and children, and younger and older adults based on the things they were physically able to do. People who hunted and gathered got very good at the things they did, but they had no way of controlling what jobs they did when. This is hard for a lot of people in the United States to understand, but farmers still live this way. Hunter-gatherers lived this way even more. Since the people lived in the wild environment, they didn't control their food production or anything else in their environment. The environment produced their food and some other things they needed by the changing seasons and the weather. Here in the United States, we have a saying, "You have to make hay while the sun shines." When the environment produces something you need, everyone has to work at collecting those things while they have the chance. Then everyone moves on to the next thing they need to do. If animals migrate through your land at a certain time of the year, that's the time of the year all the men go out to hunt them. If the fruit of a certain kind of plant ripens at a certain time of the year, that's the time of the year everyone has to go out to pick them. If fish migrate up a river at a certain time of the year, that's the time of the year everyone has to catch their fish, and so on. There are a few ways you can look at this. First of all, this is how all the animals live. Every animal is self-sufficient in finding their own food, and people who hunted and gathered had nothing else to compare their lives to, so they had no reason to think of a different economic system. Second, the cycles of the environment produced the things the people needed to use about as fast as the people used them, so no one could afford not to take advantage of the things the environment was producing at any time. Even if people could afford to let some opportunities go to waste, they still had to imagine they could afford to let the opportunity go to waste, and they had to think of something else they could be doing instead. When your river is full of fish and everyone you know is out catching fish, just like everyone you know has always done every summer, what else are you going to think about for the best way to spend your day? Third, if everyone lived out in the wild environment, and everyone knew how to get the things they needed to live in the wild environment, there was no way to force economic inequality on anyone. Since everyone knew how to provide for themselves, and everyone knew that everyone else knew how to provide for themselves, that was the economic system everyone used. Everyone worked equally hard, and everyone produced equally much. Because if you tried to force anyone to work harder than anyone else, or tried to take some of the products of someone else's work, they could leave your group and go produce the things they needed for themselves somewhere else. Everyone in the group knew they could do this, and everyone knew that everyone else knew it. So, if you were the leader of the group and you tried to tell everyone that you were so important that they should catch your food for you, they'd all laugh at you and tell you you weren't the leader of the group anymore. Every group of hunter-gathering people lived in a different environment, so some groups of people could produce more than others, and some groups had to work harder than others. Some groups couldn't afford to support any non-food-producing people, and some groups could have supported some but didn't think of it. However it happened for any particular group, the end result was that groups of hunter-gatherers didn't support many non-food-producing people. I've told you how farming was a more efficient way to produce food than hunting and gathering wild animals and plants. I've told you how farming depended on people being able to store the food they grew to eat year-round. When people started producing enough food to store year-round, it meant they had food sitting around all year. That meant some people could afford not to farm now. That meant the farmers had to work a little harder, but the work was spread out over a year, and the food was all brought in at the same time in the fall. The farmers produced a lot of food anyway, so if they worked a little harder and produced a little more food, would they notice? If 10 farmers supported one non-food-producing person among them one year, and then 2 the next, and 3 the next, and so on, would they notice that they had to work a little harder each year? When you get to 10 farmers supporting 20 non-food-producing people, they'll all have to work a lot harder than they did when they were only supporting one non-food-producing person 20 years ago. But supporting 20 non-food-producing people this year won't be much harder than supporting the 19 non-food-producing people they supported last year. The surplus food production made division of labor possible. It started out with a few people who were very good at something besides farming doing something else that benefited the farmers in exchange for food. Inventors and craftsmen could invent and build better tools for the farmers, or build better buildings for storing the food in, or whatever made farming easier. That let the farmers produce more food, and that let them produce even more of a food surplus. Now other occupations were possible also. Now the people could support full-time political leaders, so those political leaders could do more of what they were good at, organize people and figure out what the people needed to do to get the things they wanted, like keep themselves from getting conquered by their neighbors. The farmers could support full-time assistants to their political leaders to help them keep track of things. With more and more people living in the same area, thanks to all that food being produced and all those babies people were having, The people needed bigger and bigger political structures to keep everything organized, make sure all the work got done, make sure everyone did their jobs, and so on. Farmers could support full-time spiritual leaders who could devote all their time to contemplating life and thinking of things to say to cheer the farmers up. Farmers could also support full-time militaries to keep them safe. Full-time soldiers could spend all their time training and fighting wars. That gave them a big advantage over hunter-gatherer warriors who had to try to fight wars and feed themselves at the same time. Full-time militaries were also important for keeping farmers from getting conquered by their neighbors who supported full-time militaries. Each of those occupations were jobs that people had already been doing as hunter-gatherers, but now that the people who were good at them could devote all their time to them, it made a lot more things happen. The full-time inventors and craftsmen could build better weapons and armor for the full-time soldiers, and the full-time political leaders, with the help of the full-time bureaucrats, could send the soldiers to conquer more land to add to their kingdom. The full-time religious leaders could support the political leaders' decisions by saying that waging wars and conquering people was the right thing to do. The full-time inventors could invent new things, and the full-time political leaders could tell the full-time craftsmen to make a lot of them. Then they built irrigation canals for their farms, roads, bridges, dams, buildings, castles, or whatever else the political leaders wanted. Each new thing the people built let them do things that they couldn't do without that thing, or let them do something they couldn't do as easily without it. Roads let people travel faster, bridges made it easier for people to cross rivers, castles made it easier for people to defend their lands against invaders, and so on. Eventually, the Europeans built a lot of ships and learned how to sail across the ocean, where they discovered the Americas. The full-time religious leaders could figure out how to tell everyone what to do by making everyone afraid of what their gods would do to them if they disobeyed the religious leaders. The religious leaders could even use that trick on the political leaders to make the political leaders do what the religious leaders wanted them to do. Or, political leaders could decide what they wanted to do and get the religious leaders to cooperate with them. Then if the political leaders wanted to make the farmers work all the time and take all the food they produced, the religious leaders could tell everyone their god had told them that's how the world was supposed to be. That helped keep peasants from overthrowing their kings, because if a lot of them believed that their god decided this was how the world was supposed to be, a lot of peasants wouldn't see that it would do any good to overthrow their king, or they would believe they couldn't do it because the king had their god on his side. One important invention that farming made possible was metalworking. It took a lot of work for people to learn how to forge metal into tools and weapons. People were only able to do that work after farmers learned how to produce surplus food for the people to eat. It took the Mesopotamians almost 5,000 years to develop metalworking after they learned how to farm. The Inca had started metalworking just before the Europeans came to the Americas. They had made some copper arrowheads. When the conquistadors came, they had steel armor and helmets, steel swords and pikes, and muskets and cannon. The Spaniards' weapons could cut through the Incas' armor easily, and the Aztecs' and Incas' weapons couldn't cut through the Spaniards' armor at all. That was a big reason Hernan Cortes defeated Montezuma and Francisco Pizarro defeated Atahualpa. Another important invention that farming made possible was writing. Writing was another thing that was extremely useful, but very difficult to invent. It took the Mesopotamians a little over 5,000 years from the time they learned how to farm to invent writing. The Maya also invented writing, and it took them over 2,000 years from the time they learned how to farm to invent writing. Those are the only two places on Earth where people are known to have invented writing independently. The Egyptians and the Chinese might have invented writing on their own, but they both started writing after the Mesopotamians started writing, and they both shared trade routes with the Mesopotamians, so there's no way to tell if either of them learned about the idea of making marks to represent words because they saw some Mesopotamian writing, or because they heard about the idea from someone who saw it, or if they thought of the idea on their own. The Mesopotamians and the Maya both invented writing to help them remember things. The Mesopotamians invented writing to help their bureaucrats remember how much taxes everyone owed. The Maya invented writing to help them remember their calendar. The calendar was probably more important to the Maya than it was to the Mesopotamians because the Maya didn't live in as favorable an environment for farming as the Mesopotamians did, so the Maya had to remember better when to plant their crops. The Mayan calendar counts three different things. One thing they count is the cycle of 365 days in a year. The next thing they count is a cycle of 260 days, which represents the nine-month cycle of a woman's pregnancy. Those two cycles coincide once every 52 years. The third count they use to count from August 13, 3114 BC, in the same basic way that the Gregorian calendar supposedly counts from the birth of Jesus, that is, assuming he was born at the stroke of midnight on January 1st, year 1. Whatever reason the Maya had for keeping three different calendars, they believed that whatever they were counting was important enough that they were willing to go to that much trouble to count it. Hunter-gathering people could have invented writing, except that hunter-gatherers didn't need to remember or count anything badly enough to make inventing writing worth the trouble. They could paint or carve pictures on rocks, so obviously they knew the things they needed to know to be able to invent writing. But they lived simple enough lives that they could remember everything they needed to remember without having to invent a different mark to represent each word in their language. Writing was very valuable for people who had it, and it would have been valuable for everyone else if only they'd had it. Writing helped people communicate. You already know what happened when people learned how to talk and share their ideas with each other that way. Writing let people share their ideas with even more people. Writing let people communicate ideas with people they never met. It let them communicate ideas with people who lived at other times. It let them communicate more specific ideas, and it let them record ideas to remember again later. People who couldn't read or write could only communicate ideas with people they met in person and could talk to. They could only hear as many words as the person said, and they couldn't remember all of them. People could keep oral histories of their people, but the only people who could remember specific events are the people who were old enough to live through them. If your grandfather told you a story about something that happened to him when he was a boy, you can tell the story to your own children, but you couldn't tell it as well as your grandfather could tell it. When your grandfather died, all the history he knew would be lost. People who can read and write can write letters or journals or books that other people can read and learn from. The people who write those things can write down specific things they want other people to know. Those books or letters can be read by people who never met the person who read them, or they can be sent from one person to another so the other person can learn something without meeting the person who wrote the words. A person can write something down and then people can read it after he's dead. If your grandfather wrote down a story about something that happened to him when he was a boy, your son can read your grandfather's words after your grandfather is dead and still learn the story directly from your grandfather. Likewise, people who learn important things can write those things down so that other people can learn them easily, instead of having to back up and learn them all over again on their own. For instance, before the Europeans came to the Americas, some of them figured out how to build ships and wrote down what they learned. They figured out how to navigate by the stars and wrote that down. Then Christopher Columbus discovered the Americas and wrote down a map to show people how to get there. Then Hernan Cortes got a copy of the map and came here with the conquistadors. Then he met Montezuma, fought him, and won. Then he wrote that down. Then Francisco Pizarro read what Hernan Cortes wrote, got another copy of Columbus's map, came to South America, and met Atahualpa. And when he did, he used the same trick to defeat Atahualpa that Hernan Cortes used to defeat Montezuma. Pizarro learned Cortes's trick because he knew how to read, But Atahualpa didn't learn what happened to Montezuma because he didn't know how to read. I told you how you can see the scientific story of the origins of life continuing to be told in any living thing you look at. So let's look at how it's playing out in this agricultural history of the world. Life began because that original gene molecule made replicas of itself. It continued because gene molecules built cells, genes stuck together in cells, and cells stuck together to make larger life forms. Now humans have thousands of genes and billions of cells, and our genes made our brains to make us replicate our genes. Other genes created plants, and others created animals. There are two main ways you can see that happening in this history of the world. First of all, humans helped some animals and plants to replicate their genes, and they used the animals and plants to help themselves replicate their own genes. When humans found plants or animals that they could use for food, they planted the seeds of those plants, and they tamed the animals, brought them home, and bred them. Those animals and plants had a lot more children because of what the humans did. Having children is exactly what the plants and animals were trying to do. The humans brought those plants and animals home because they had characteristics that were useful to humans. When the humans bred the plants and animals with the best characteristics, they helped the plants and animals with the best characteristics make the most children that were like themselves. That means that when people learned how to farm, they made wild plants and animals evolve into domestic plants and animals. Domestic plants and animals are different from their wild ancestors, and they are different precisely because they have characteristics that are more useful to humans. Dogs are more friendly to humans than wolves are, domestic tomato plants grow bigger tomatoes than wild tomato plants, and so on. When farmers continue to breed domestic plants and animals, they make evolution continue to happen. They produce different breeds of dogs that are good at different things, like hunting or guarding someone's house or helping to herd sheep or whatever. They produce breeds of tomatoes or corn or whatever that's bigger than the others or sweeter than the others or whatever. The other way you can see the scientific story of the origin of life continue to play out in this story is by the way people acted. People are made out of genes that replicate themselves by extremely complicated processes. It sounds absurd to think this agricultural history of the world was a story of genes replicating themselves, but consider this. The Mesopotamians and the Maya each learned how to farm because that let them produce the most food. They needed food to live. When they produced more food, they could have more children. When they had children, they made copies of their genes and put them into their children. Each child is half a copy of its mother and half a copy of its father, because each child carries half of the mother's genes and half of the father's genes. Then the Europeans got the Mesopotamians' agriculture, and they did the same thing. Then they built ships, discovered the Americas, and colonized them. When the Europeans colonized the Americas, they killed a lot of Maya, Aztecs, Inca, and other Native Americans. Then the Europeans settled on the Native Americans' land, planted their crops there, grew their food, had more children, and filled up the Americas, especially the United States and Canada, with European descendants. The Maya did the same thing, but they weren't as successful. They learned to farm, built their empire, and conquered other people. But, for their various reasons, the Native American empires weren't as physically powerful as the European empires, so when the two groups met, the Europeans won. The Europeans were made up of gene molecules that were trying to replicate themselves by extremely complex chemical reactions. When the Europeans sailed the seas, colonized new lands, built farms, and had many children, replicating their genes was exactly what they did. Now you can see the part of the origins of life story where the world filled up with genes, but some genes were able to kill other genes and use their atoms to make more copies of themselves. Native Americans hunted animals, ate them, and had children. The Maya learned how to farm, built their empire, conquered the people around them, killed a lot of people, took what they had, and had children. Then other empires came and went, and more people conquered other people, took what they had, and had children. Then the Europeans came, conquered everyone, killed a lot of people, took what they had, and had children. Now you can see why the story of the origin of life is so valuable. You can see it happening to you right now. The capitalists are trying to conquer you, take what you have, and send you to work in their factories, which is almost the same thing as killing you. Why are they doing it? It's not necessarily so they can have bigger families than they could have if they didn't take your farms. It could be so they can buy more things for the children they do have, like better educations, bigger houses, better clothes, and so on, so their children can be more successful. It's not necessarily so they can have bigger families than they could have if they didn't take your farms. It could be so they could buy more things for their children. It could be so they could buy more things for the children they do have, like better educations, bigger houses, better clothes, and so on, so their children can be more successful. If their children are more successful, they'll be better able to have children of their own. Alternately, it could be because the people who are taking your farms want to buy more things for themselves. If they've already had their children and their children are grown up and making their own livings now, the capitalists can use the money they make from taking your farms to buy things for themselves, to make better lives for themselves, which means to help them keep their own genes alive. The other way this story of the origins of life is so valuable is because by knowing how to recognize it, we can choose to act differently. People, and especially capitalists, think they're so smart because they've invented a lot of machines, computers, airplanes, electrical power plants, and so on. But when you look at the way people have been using their machines, you can see that they aren't nearly as smart as they think they are, because they're still acting just like animals. When you put a new species of animal into an environment, the population of the animal expands to fill up the environment. That pushes other species of animal out of their way. That's happened a lot with European animals that Europeans brought to their colonies and then escaped. Now European rats live in the jungles of South America or on islands in the Caribbean or wherever, and some local animals have all died out because the rats ate all their food. When you look at how the Europeans have acted, or how the Maya acted, or how many other groups of people have acted, you can see that they haven't acted any differently from animals, not even rats. What they did was a lot more complicated than what animals do, but that's all. Beneath their superficial details, it was the same thing. Now, when you look at the capitalists taking your farms, you can see they're doing the same thing too. We can use our brains to figure out a different way to act so that people can stop conquering each other, killing each other, and making each other miserable. But if we want to do that, we have to use our brains. If we just do whatever feels right to us, we'll keep right on acting like animals without even knowing it. This is a big reason why knowing how plants and animals live is the most important thing people can know about. As farmers, you've seen most of the things I'm telling you about happen to other animals. All I've had to do is to show you how the same things happen to people all over the whole world, and show you how to recognize why the same things that happen on your farms happen all over the world. I think now you can see how Americans and the people who are taking your farms, not knowing anything about how plants and animals live, is such a big problem. I can teach these things to you, but can anyone teach it to them? If they can't learn these things, they can't recognize the mistakes they're making, so they can't change their minds and start acting differently. But if they know so little about how plants and animals live, why do they think they know how to be farmers for the whole world? Imperialistic people love to find out about things like this and say that the fact they conquered the world proves they're fulfilling their roles in the world by survival of the fittest. But that's just an example of people who don't understand what science is, not looking at all the evidence. It's easy to say you're fulfilling your part of the natural cycles of the world by survival of the fittest when you're winning. But the simple fact that people don't like being conquered proves that human behavior just isn't as simple as everyone learning to accept survival of the fittest as their political system. One ability people have is the ability to cooperate with others for their mutual protection. Another ability people have is the ability to think of these things ahead of time and realize that conquering people is only going to result in people fighting back against their conquerors. And as anti-capitalist revolutionaries, that's exactly what we're doing. There is one other valuable thing we can see from this version of the history of the world. All of world history, for the past 10,000 years, happened the way it happened because of farmers. A lot of people have done a lot of things over the past 10,000 years, but in the end, the people who knew how to grow the most food won.